leaving stuff outside. And then we did not put the amendments for approval or for them in order to be factored in into the bill. And then we are thinking that today then we should be able to do that so that the bill can be finalized so that we are able to go through it on clause by clause. And then again last week, I think in relation to the refugee amendment bill, and then we agreed that we'll deliberate today. And then also the department was supposed to assist us to factor in the new proposals. I think there were two, three new proposals for insertion in relation to their responses to the submissions we have received. And then probably then they will be the first to actually help us out where they have thrown in those amendments or those proposals. And then from then we'll be able to deliberate. The other issue, of course, is that the DA promised that they want to make some sort of inputs or proposals. And we agreed with them that their proposals will be welcomed, but we tried to say that they should make sure that they've sent the amendments by Thursday night last week so that we are able to talk to them so that today then we can have an intelligent discussion on them. But as far as my memory serves me well, I have not received such. And we have spoken to the secretary to actually remind them as early as that Thursday last week. But constantly the emails sent by AD did not really lead us to any success on the matter. And until I think the last email that came from Honorable Hussein was that those proposals are not yet completed. As soon as they are completed, then they will be forwarded. And until today, I'm not aware of that particular document. We will then be informed as we get into this specific item. And then today, I think from the Department of Home Affairs, then I've seen the DG is around here, and then I've seen the DDG for Immigration, Mr. McKay, I've seen him is here. And then Erasmus is almost becoming part of us now here. And then Mandla Madumisa is here as well, just like Erasmus and Malakata as well. And then I think they need to have now a permanent accommodation in Cape Town. And then we have got Mr. Sloth Nielsen, the scratch hair, is here as well. He's getting used to Cape Town. And then we have got Mr. Holmes, the RAB chairperson as well, and then also is the same thing. Samuel Mandiwana, have I seen him today? You haven't bunked our meeting today. Congratulations. And then Elroy Africa is here. And then from the state law advisors, then they are really serious about cutting costs. It's only Yolanda that is here today. And I think it should be appreciated. Yes, tightening the belt. From Parliamentary Legal Services, then we have got Suen Isaac. She's here. It's on my right. Second right. Whatever it is called. And then, I'm stuck with the handwriting, actually. And then, let me go to the apologies on honorable members. Let me just jump where I've got a problem. But of course, we've got an intern in legal services. I think it's the second one now to swear. I can't read the handwriting here. Let me just be honest. The letters have been put together in a manner that I can't read them. And then Dr. Melder's late arrival, Ms. Mnisi, late arrival, Ms. S.J. Nkomo, is not going to be with us. And how do you read that? Yes, and then whatever. Yes, I think that is the delegation that we have today. And then, of course, then we have got our parliamentary portfolio committee assistants that are here. Welcome, Honorable Hussein. Then I'm sure some are maybe from media, right at the end, interested in the business of Home Affairs. And the only department in the country that deals with the living and the dead, the citizen and the non-citizens who are inside the country. And in other words, it's a department that is dealing with more than 55 or 60 million people, more than that. It's the only department dealing with that. But unfortunately, is that what we need to say is that it is not adequately resourced to be able to discharge its functions to such a number of people on a daily basis. Honorable members, I think that is you still made it more difficult. What is that thing there? Is that Modivedi? Yes, I think the intern is Modivedi Tabang. Yes, now it is written in the manner that I can read. Thank you very much, and then enjoy the travels of this committee. Okay. So, honorable members, I think we need to go to item 3 straight away and then ask the department to actually assist us with what they proposed last week on this particular, on their responses to the amendment bill and the presentations that we have received from different stakeholders. If you are ready, then you may proceed.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and the Honorable Members. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll be handing over now to our legal team to take us through the matters.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honorable Members, good morning. As we agreed last week when we were at the committee meeting, there were certain clauses that were proposed, and it was requested that we just put that in the correct format to the committee. We've done that. And Chair, I just want to indicate that we submitted that document to the committee, but there are just a few amendments, and I'll indicate them here, just wording that's used incorrectly that we just corrected, and we'll just I'll indicate that where that is in the document. So, Chair, the first amendment that we propose is to with regard to clause 3, and what we've done in that document is remember the words "in any way." That we said it was too vague, etc., and then we said that in the prescribed circumstances. So you do in the regulations, you prescribe the circumstances in which this will take place. So that was then in clause 3, so it's on page 4 in line 10 of the self to omit "in any way." We're doing away with that, and we're substituting with the words "in the prescribed circumstances" to cater for it so that we've got an enabling provision to do that in the regulations. And the next one that we did was the issue about resolves. Where we said that we're not going to indicate that the minister resolves this, there must be an order that's issued in this regard. So on page 4, in line 32, after the word "minister," we're omitting the word "resolves," and we're substituting that word with the words "may issue an order." Chair, that was with regard to clause 3 of the bill. Then the next one where we had a suggested amendment, Chair, was with regard to clause 13 of the bill. And this deals with the issue of the single members hearing the reviews, etc. So what we said there is on page 7, after line 3, we're omitting subsection 2, and obviously we're substituting it with the following subsection. We said any function performed by the Standing Committee in terms of this Act must be determined by a single member or, in particular matters, such number of members of the Standing Committee as the Chairperson may consider necessary. And then on page 7, Chair, with regard to the word administrative, we indicated that we going to do away with the words the monitoring or supervisory after administrative. So what we just basically doing, those the words monitoring and supervisory is being deleted from the text there, so that this just indicates administrative functions. Chair, if we move to clause 18 was the next suggested amendments that we had, and what we indicated there was after the word UNHCR, we wanted to include the words or any other charitable organization or person. So that is both in respect of points 1 and point 2 in line 52. So what we did there, in the document you have, we indicated on page 10 on line 52. That on must just be changed to in. So it will be on page 10 in line 52. After UNHCR to insert or any other charitable organization or person. And if we look at number 2 there, Chair, it's also on page 10, that on must also be changed to in line 57, after UNHCR to insert the words or any other charitable organization or person. Then the third one that we have there, Chairperson, is on page 11, and once again, that on must just change to in line 28. After the word institutionalization, to insert, once again, any other compelling reason of a similar nature. And then on page 11, in line 31, after the word with, to insert the word as an illegal foreigner. And the fifth one is on page 11, also in line 32, after the word terms, to insert of section 32. So that person will be dealt with as an illegal foreigner in terms of section 32 of the Immigration Act. We just remember we wanted to bring clarity there, Chair, with regard to the cross-referencing. The next issue we dealt with, Chair, was in terms of clause 20, which also deals with the asylum seekers whose application of asylum has been rejected. What we're basically doing there is we are substituting paragraph A of subsection 5 of the following paragraph, and that's just to correct incorrect cross-referencing, etc. So what we're saying is that any asylum seeker whose application for asylum has been rejected in terms of subsection 3B and confirmed by the... Previously it was Director General, but remember we've got the Standing Committee that does this, so we're just deleting Director General and we retaining Standing Committee in terms of section, and it's in terms of section 24A, subsection 2, not 3. So it's just a correction that's being made, so that the cross-referencing is correct, Chair. Must be dealt with as an illegal foreigner in terms of section 32 of the Immigration Act, which then ties in with our amendment as well on clause 18, which I just alluded to in the previous discussion, Chair. Then on page 12, in line 9, Chair, we're omitting the word D, and we're substituting that with E, because we're including a new A, so they will move down A. A will become B, B will become C, etc. So it's just a technical amendment. So D will now become E. Chair, if we move, the next amendment that we have is with regard to clause 21 of the bill. And there we're saying that, and here's one of the things that we just want to, we need to align clause 21 with clause 13, Chair. And you'll see that the word that you have there, this deals with a review of the Standing Committee. So you're saying a review contemplated in subsection 1, there's the word may, that may must be read must be determined, and then by a single member or such number of members of the Standing Committee as the chairperson may consider necessary, and that ties in then with the amendments to clause 13. Then the second amendment that we're suggesting there, Chair, is that on page 12, and it's not on, it must be in line 24, after the word decision to insert, in the comma, where after the Standing Committee will be functus officio. And that just aligns with the court cases that we have where after decision has been made by the RSTO and it's been reviewed by the Standing, they are functus officio in this regard once it's been communicated. Chair, the next amendment we're suggesting is to clause 27, where we discuss the issue about the notices, etc., where we're saying on page 13, in line 47, after the word thereto, to insert the following words, provided that no such notice is required if the withdrawal is requested by the refugee concerned. So So if the refugee requests that the withdrawal must be done, he or she wants to go back to his or her country, whatever the case may be, then the notice that needs to be published in this regard will not be required. We're also saying on page 13 in line 48 then, to omit the word resolved, and it just ties back to an earlier amendment that we discussed, and we're substituting that with issued an order. So we're aligning the sections where the minister will then issue an order in this regard, and it's not going to be where the minister just resolves on the matter. On page 13, Chair, in line 53, once again, after the word with, we're inserting the word as an illegal foreigner, and also again on page 13 in line 53, after the word terms, to insert of section 32, and it just ties back to an earlier amendment that we're saying that such a person will be dealt with as an illegal foreigner in terms of section 32 of the Immigration Act. Chair, the last one that we do with regard to clause 31, we were saying on page 14, now the word from line 23, that must be changed. It's on page 14, after line 31. We must say to, and then we delete the word, this omit section 31 and to substitute with, that must be deleted. It must read to insert the following section, because 31 currently is still being retained. So this is just a new insertion, and this deals with the transitional provisions that we discussed last time as well, Chair, with regard to the Refugee Appeals Board, any matters that are currently before the Refugee Appeals Board, etc. Chair, there's just another issue that we want to mention here. As far as the Refugee Appeals Board, the transitional provisions deals with the Refugee Appeals Board, now the newly to be created Refugee Appeals Authority. The question that arises is, obviously, your Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs would also have certain matters in this regard that would be backlogs. So just as the RAB is applicable, I think we should also make this, it's just something that we thought about, where we said that it should also be applicable to the Standing Committee in this regard, because there are also backlogs there. And the issue about single members, etc., it's also dealt with in terms of the same issues with regard to the RAB, Chair. Thanks, Jim. That's the presentations that we have as from the department, Sam, as was requested by the committee last time. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much. And it is exhaustive. And of course, is that whatever also will be left on SCRA, then. It cannot fall through the cracks. It can't fall through the cracks. And then we must make sure that we provide, you know, for continuation with that particular work. The only thing is that the modus operandi in terms of the warm bodies that we'll be dealing with then will be done in accordance with the new legislation. But that work cannot be thrown away or discarded or whatever. And then I think is that transitional arrangement as well needs to be made very clear for SCRA as well. Honourable members, I think we have received the input from the department, and then is there any person that wants to get more clarity on the submissions that have been made now before we really actually discuss them? Whether we just need further clarity from the department, what is there that they mean by what they have actually put in here? Because you remember that it was narrative in last week's input. Now it has been reduced to amendments. Provisions that must go into the bill, then they may have taken a different shape now in here, because also there are consequential matters relating to those narrative proposals in last week's work. Honorable Hussein, is there anything that they must explain a little bit more to you?
The button is far away from this mic. I'm sorry. Chair, how are you?
Mom, can you just switch that mic off? Yeah.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I just have two questions of clarity that I want to ask. I understand that there are other there's going to be another opportunity to discuss it. The first one, Chair, just relates to the First Amendment. I'll just find that quickly. It's the one in Clause 3, the removal of the words "in any way." I'm not understanding what the justification for it is, unless I missed it. Because if somebody leaves the country, if a refugee leaves South Africa and goes back to his home country, why does it matter to us how he goes there? If he goes, then he's gone, he loses his refugee status, I understand that. But why do we have, what's the justification for removing the words "in any way"? I might have missed the explanation. And then, Chair, the second one is on page 6 of this document, which relates to, I think, Clause 18. I just want to understand, you see this part where it says, "or any other compelling reasons of a similar nature." And it's the words there, "similar nature," that I'm confused about, which, and I just want to understand again what's the justification for that. If I'm reading this, I understand that if the person is in hospital or is institutionalized in some, maybe in a correctional services facility, and then you say, "or any other compelling reason of a similar nature," which means he must be held up in some institution, but there might be other compelling reasons that are not necessarily of a similar nature. So if you can just explain why is it necessary to say "of a similar nature," and why don't we just stop there at "or any other compelling reason," because then you leave the reasons a little bit more broad. Just those two, Chair. Thank you.
Have you followed him, Erasmus? And then you think you are ready to actually talk to the issues? If so, proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Yes, indeed. Chair, with regard to the Clause 3 in any way, what was discussed last time was to say that, and the comments that we received from the members of the public was to say that "in any way" is very vague. We should rather then, and this is what I indicated earlier, say "in the prescribed circumstances." But we neither here nor there, if it's any way, if the committee wishes to keep "in any way," it's fine. But "in the prescribed circumstances" would provide more clarity, because it would say then, in the regulations you will indicate that these are the circumstances under which the person will go, or whatever the case may be. So it was just a question of clarity that came out of the, and we wanted to say, right, in order for us to clarify that or bring more clarity, one will say "in the prescribed circumstance," and meaning that you'll have to do regulations in this regard to indicate what it is. But it's neither here nor there as far as the department is concerned, Chair. Then with regard to the issue about "or any other compelling reasons of a similar nature," Chair, there might be other circumstances that could arise in this regard, and I think what we're trying to do is just to make sure that if other you're not linked to those specific ones, the institutionalization, etc., there might be other circumstances that could arise, and maybe Mr. Madumisa can explain further on the specific issue. But we just want to make sure that you can deal with each and every case that comes to you in that specific circumstance. So it's, once again, it's just a clarity-providing provision to say that you're not locked into this specific, the four corners of these walls, if something else, because sometimes it does happen where something arises that's not catered for in the legislation, and then you can bring it under the specific section. Thanks, Chair.
Can we check Madumisa whether he has got more light to put on the explanation? If ever there is anything extra to be said? proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, members of the committee. I think my colleague has covered it, but what we are trying to do is to keep in line with the conventions and protocol on the protection of persons of concern. So we are trying to say we understand that the circumstances of which then we might need to deal with are complex. We might not have a specific list, so it's important that to keep that flexibility.
I've seen Honorable Hussein nodding as you're explaining those two issues. I'm just taking for granted that he agrees, now he understands what you're trying to say, and unless otherwise there is a follow-up.
I understand. I don't agree, but you're going to give me a chance again to tell you why, I assume.
I know, you don't take long.
My nodding is just to say, yes, I understand. It doesn't mean that, yes, I agree.
I know, it don't take long to understand. You are a fast mover. I don't want to say fast learner, I see. Yes, and Honorable Mkalipi.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair, although I'm still Honorable Sophie because the DG does not want to change my surname. No, I'm just joking. I'm joking, DG. No, I just want to get a clarity here, Chair. On clause 18, number 4 on page 11, I just want to understand the word illegal foreigner. Why the department? Because I can see even if you go to clause 20, and also powers of the Director General versus the Standing Committee in terms of Section 24A, it also talks about illegal foreigner. I just want to get a clarity from the department. Whom do you regard as illegal foreigner? I hope you are not referring to our African brothers. Also, to clause 21, Chair, I think Honorable Hussein was also touching on the very same word, may, stroke must. And then just to get a clarity, because it says that a review contemplated in subsection 1 may be determined by a single member. I just want to get a clarity. A single member of a standing committee can be given those powers. That's what the department is proposing. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I think, Sir Erasmus, you can proceed. The only thing is that some of these things, I think they've been dealt with last week, but I think you can just repeat them.
Thanks, Chair. With regard to Honourable Members, question regarding the issue about as an illegal foreigner, the inclusion of the words there is to make sure if a person has been rejected finally, etc., the review has been finalized, appeals have been finalized, that person becomes an illegal foreigner. And what happened is previously we said to dealt with as an illegal foreigner in terms of the Immigration Act, but we need to be clear now, and what we're saying is that person will be dealt with as an illegal foreigner because that person doesn't have a status in the country now. So now you have to have certain legislation in place in order to deal with this foreigner. Because he or she is an illegal foreigner, what would then happen is Section 32 of the Immigration Act deals with illegal foreigners. So that's why we've put that in there. Chairperson. And with regard to, I think, the issue about the single member, yes, the idea is to have scrass it as individual members and also then the Refugee Appeals Board, but I think that has been answered by Chairperson in this regard as well. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I'm sure Honourable Hlaope would also assist us that when a foreign national is in the country and is not documented, we really don't know about that person in terms of our legal documents, then he's an illegal foreigner. If he's not documented, and then he will be on our grounds illegal. All what it is left is that for that particular person to try and find some other vehicles that can assist him or her to get documented, to actually migrate from being illegal foreigner and then to a legal foreigner. And then that is what it needs to happen. It doesn't matter what color that person is having. It doesn't matter what color that person is having. As long as he's not documented to be within our boundaries, then should be regarded as an illegal person until other things happens. And I know your passion. But to really follow that passion, we may be breaking some of the laws that we have taken oath to uphold. Honorable members, is there any other thing to be explained on this presentation that have been made today for clarity? Because we needed to actually now move to the next session of actually now talking to ourselves so that then the department can just do the listening as good spectators. Welcome, Honorable Mnisi and Honorable Tambuza. Thank you very much. I thought you raised a hand, Honorable Hussein. Yeah. Or you have withdrawn your hand.
No, I have, Chair, but I'm waiting on your calls.
No, proceed if there is still anything to be clarified.
Yeah, Chair, just on the first point, I mean, I'm not really hung up on it. I just don't think it's necessary for us to prescribe how people must go back to their countries. Because if they choose, you know, to take a route that's not prescribed, then what's going to happen to them? I mean, there's nothing we're going to do. They're going to, their refugee status will just be cancelled. That's it. But it's not something I'll die in the ditch for. I just think it's not necessary. But
yeah, you are making my life difficult.
Why?
You're making my life difficult. Because now you are actually debating it. I thought that you needed clarity. Now you chose that you have heard them properly.
Yes.
Then wait for our discussions.
So
I wanted clarity from other members if they've got anything for them to explain. This input they have made.
No,
so that you understand them properly, that when we get to the discussion now, then we can be able to do it.
I'm fine with that. I understood. Misunderstood you, obviously.
It's fine.
So you must just tell me when you...
Let me just check with other honorable members whether they've got anything to be explained a little bit more. Also remember that there is one that is not here. The transitional provisions, as has been explained. Because this transitional provision that's here on clause 31, it only deals with the RAB. And then we are saying there is a similar transitional arrangement for SCRA. Erasmus, that unholy meeting can end. And then, thank you very much. We're saying that the transitional arrangement that is on 31 here, it's for only the RAB. Then you are going to craft another one for SCRA. So that the work of SCRA, after the signing of this one, then must still continue. If there are backlogs, they must still continue to be processed, not to be thrown away that the law has been changed. So we have that as well that's coming. And if there is no any other thing, then I think then we can ask the DG whether there is any closing thing. Around this input that have been made?
No, Chair, I think everything was explained. Just be waiting.
You are afraid to say the ball is in your court. Okay, now you can change gears. Go to a gear where you are just quiet, and just doing the listening. You'll speak as and when we ask you to actually help us. But otherwise, save all your energy. Honorable Hussein, you need to help us before we move forward. Last week you promised to make proposals. And we agreed that you're going to make the proposals. You'll help us with those proposals by Thursday night. And then it looks like we have not landed our hands on them. And then until your last communication, which I'm aware of, is where you said now is you apologize for not having completed them. But the minute you complete them, then you'll forward them. But then it looks like I haven't seen anything on the pipeline. Then I think you have got an opportunity now to help us out on that specific matter. You may proceed.
Chair, thank you very much. You're quite correct. I did indicate that, I apologize that our submission is not ready. And I also said that I'll forward it as soon as it is. I'm sure you understand that there are other principles that I have to consult before I get to that point. So without going into the detail, I really am sorry that I'm unable to put that before the committee today. And the moment it is ready, I will make sure that it's forwarded through to through Eddie. But I also don't want to be unfair and hold up the legislative process. So we must continue as you have planned to do so in the committee. And the moment it is ready, I will send it through. And then you can decide how you think it's best to deal with it. But I'm sorry it's not ready today for whatever reason.
Okay. Let me just check with the department. This amendment that we have just spoken to this morning, they have been factored in the amendment bill. Rasmus?
Chairperson, I'm not as yet. Remember, these are the amendments based on the inputs that we received from the members of the public that the department has also indicated. So what would need to happen now is if the committee is in agreement with amendments as they are now, we will factor them in. It will form part of your A list, etc., and will be it will be factored into the bill, your B bill at the end of the day, Chair. So this is just a suggestion thus far, which needs to be approved by the committee so that we can have that in the A list, Chair.
Okay. Okay. All right. I think this. Let's then get to the bill itself. Then, together with the amendments and the submissions that have been made, and then so that we are able to agree on the A list. Honorable Hussein wanted to start. And then I think you can begin that.
Chair, thank you. I managed to slip in the first issue. I don't want to go back to that. I think there's just three. The second one relates to page 6 on this document. It goes back to the issue of the similar nature, and I understand the explanation, but it's exactly for that reason.
Page 6, I talk about the amendment.
Clause 12, let me just rather refer to clauses, where you suggest you want to include the words or any other compelling reason of a similar nature.
The Refugees Amendment Bill, honorable members. B12, 2016, page 6, that's where Honorable Hussein is saying that he is speaking to. And then on page 6, which clause, Honorable Hussein?
Clause 12.
Clause 12.
I'm referring to those words marked in blue, or any other compelling reason of a similar nature.
Then we've got it's a different document. It's the one that I was asking whether this has been factored in.
Chair, if I may assist in this regard, there's a document that we also put the members,
yes.
We said legends colouring, and that's on
yes,
page 6. It's just easier to follow that.
Just
one,
with
yeah.
Red and blue.
That's correct, Chair.
Yes, those are the ones that where you affected those amendments. To
indeed. Just to make it clear for the committee,
yes.
How it would read in the bill if we take
in
all
the
that.
Bill.
Thanks.
Chief agreed, yes.
Yeah.
Are we having that document, all of you, honorable members? There is, it has got legends on front. In coloring, the red represents deletion from provisions, and then B, blue, represent proposed insertions in the provision. Okay? Oh, you got it in a black and white? Okay. Oh, but I think it was not a counter-revolutionary sabotage. It is just an honest mistake by a gadget in an office which cannot print in color. Okay. Are we all having that document? Then Honorable Hussein is taking us to a page 6 of that document. Remember that, honorable members, I think as it has been explained, is those amendments that the department was speaking to, now they've been factored in how they will look in the bill. Only those ones in this particular document, so that we can close up on them. You may proceed, Honorable Hussein. It looks like we all have the same document now.
Thank you, Chair. So, Chair, when I listen to the response from the department, which I say is very reasonable, that you're trying to prevent a situation where you limit that situation to hospitalization and institutionalization. So you're trying to prevent that, which is why you added the words any other compelling reason. I agree. But where I think the problem comes in is when you add those words of a similar nature. And I want to suggest that you consider stopping there at compelling reason, because then you'll achieve exactly what you suggested you'll achieve. Because when you say of a similar nature, then you're limiting the thing even further now. I'll give you an example. If somebody has not come in because there was a funeral in his family, that's not a similar nature to hospitalization or institutionalization. Do you see the point I'm making? So I'm suggesting that you rather stop at any other compelling reason. It achieves what you want to achieve. You leave it open, and you allow for that discretion to be able to say, this is a compelling reason. It achieves the same thing. I just think those words will make it a little bit more difficult. Then, Chair, I'm going to jump to page 9. And there on clause 2, I'll just read it so that you can follow. It says, the standing committee must inform each affected person contemplated in subsection 1 of its intention to withdraw his or her status as a refugee, as well as the reasons for the withdrawal, and such person may, within a prescribed period. Now, I'm not referring to the blue section, I'm referring to the words in the top. And the question I want to ask, and this is currently, I think, a problem in the system, in that the amount of time it takes before a refugee is informed, an asylum seeker is informed, of what his status is. That gap takes far too long, which is generally huge complaints. And is there any reason why you can't also equally put in a prescribed time for the asylum seeker to be informed? Because you only say that the asylum seeker must, within the prescribed period, make a written submission. Why can't the same principle be implemented for the department to inform the asylum seeker within a prescribed time? So in that way, you reduce and you ensure that people who apply for asylum are informed timeously, which at the moment is not happening. It takes a long time for them to even get a straightforward answer. And therein lies a problem with the system. And I think that we should put in the law so that you can give people the comfort, the asylum seekers the comfort, knowing that the department must do this work within a certain period of time. And you can change that period of time based on prescription. But if you add the words in there within the prescribed time, it gives, I think it would be fair and balanced. So I'd like to hear what your thoughts are if it's going to make a massive difference. I think that would be fair and balanced. I don't think it's fair that you only give the asylum seekers a set amount of time in which they must apply. I think the department must equally make a decision within a prescribed time. Yeah, Chair, those were just the three. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Especially on the last one that you have just raised. Because, of course, it's ordinarily that particular prescribed time then would have an implication that it must talk from the date that the decision has been made. You know, it's because if it is made on the basis of the day that an application is put in, then that will be problematic. Remember that I think also the other thing that is very problematic is when a prescribed time has been put in place and then the department fails to comply with it, what then happens? What then happens? Yeah. Honorable members, is there any other one that wants to actually engage on other things? Remember that we are engaging right through the whole bill. Whatever you wanted to raise, you know, even on other sections. We are talking to ourselves, but in the presence of the department, so that then all those that needs to be explained, they will be called upon to explain. Erasmus, can you respond to those two? Can you respond to those two, and then you'll come back?
Yeah, Chase, it's on the point that you raise now, just so that I can clarify this. I mean, I would prefer ideally that the prescribed time should be from the time of application, because
but
the department must respond.
Because
the main argument of making all of these adjustments is to streamline the whole process. There's these massive resource and capacity problems. That's why we're bringing in all these changes. So if the argument is we're bringing these changes to speed up the process, streamline it, then we must hold the department accountable to do that within a prescribed time. So that we can avoid the problems that we're sitting with. Or else the argument that they're doing this to streamline it, then to me, I'm not convinced that that would be the case. So I'd like to hear what their responses are to both, that within a prescribed time of the application or within the, within a prescribed time of the decision being made. Either of the two, I'd like to hear the response to. Thanks, Jay.
Okay. Rasmus?
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me start with the last one that we're dealing with. What I want to indicate is we know about capacity constraints. Yes, we're also looking at streamlining the processes and procedures, etc. But as I indicated last time as well, PAJA is always applicable. So remember, and each and every case is determined on his or its own merits. So in certain instances, there might be country reports that you need to invest. So if you're going to tie yourself down to a specific or prescribed period and you can't do it, you might have applications in, against you in court on that specific matter because you're saying that I'll do it in the prescribed period in terms of the legislation. But you cannot do it because of investigations that need to be done. And each case differs from based on the information that's placed before the RSDO, et cetera, or the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, the Refugee Appeals Authority, et cetera. The checks and balances that are in place in this specific regard is PAJA. So in other words, if a person feels aggrieved by the decision that's been, and, or it's taking too long, there's always the PAJA route that can be followed and it can be taken to court. One also has to take into consideration the capacity issues that we're dealing with, etc. So you're trying to navigate through all these specific processes and procedures in order to deal with a specific issue. So obviously there is checks and balances in place, and to place something in the legislation that you'll do it within a prescribed period and you nail yourself down to that specific period is going to cause, is going to hamper the process going forward in our view.
The one on page 6. Of similar nature.
Thanks, Chair. With regard to the similar nature, as we've indicated, that we need to keep that in line with our international instruments, etc. So it might not fall specifically within these. So we're saying of any similar, I understand where the member is coming from, that we maybe, so it's something we need to maybe go back and just check, and that specific, if we might change that wording there to make clear the intention that we have, where we want to keep it in line with your international instruments, because there might be something that's mentioned there that doesn't fall within the specific category, i.e. institutionalization, hospitalization, that you wanted to be able to take that into account. So we'll look at that, Chair, and then we'll revert on that as well. Thanks, Chair.
But as anyone that is reading it, anyone who is just reading this, if you remove of similar nature, what would be the interpretation? Is there any danger? Is there any train smash? If you just come across this particular clause and then you read it without those words of similar nature, do you think that there is a crisis? Can you help? Can you help?
Yes. Thanks, Chairperson. For us, Chairperson, as a department, the answer is yes, there is a concern. We don't want compelling reasons that are beyond international protection. We want compelling reasons to be aligned with the need to protect persons. So if we keep it open, we agree that the word similar nature might not necessarily give the tie the matter to where we want to tie it. But we are saying we might need to look at how best do we find then a wording that still keeps us in ensuring that compelling reasons should be compelling reasons within international protection, not any other compelling reason as a person will see fit or necessary.
But what is in front of us doesn't say that. It just simply says of similar nature. It doesn't make any reference to any particular provision somewhere else.
That's why
can we then improve it to actually narrow to the intention? Because if it just says similar nature, then it means to these ones that have been mentioned just up in front. And that is what the Honorable Member is saying is problematic, because there are other reasons that are not similar to these, but that might influence these things. Can we then just try and improve the similar nature so that there is a clear reference to what that prescribes that to those particular reasons or whatever, so that at least when people look at any other reason, then they must have that narrow area to look at it and say, if it doesn't fall within this, then it is not taken. Unless if we are not able to read your provision in the manner, remember that we are not lawyers like you, but we are politicians, and we do try and understand what you are saying, and then we were able to speak to it. So we are speaking from the layman's view. When I meet this, when I read it, I must be able to interpret like you. Otherwise, then it doesn't help us. Yeah.
Because to me, what I'm thinking, I think it's still even opening us. Now, if we say any other, I'm trying to check whether maybe when we say, when this similar, we only want to mean only on issues which are related to health, because that one we don't have a control. Let's say now you are involved in an accident.
Yeah.
But if I'm in an accident, I might not yet be hospitalized, but it's something which I have maybe. So rather than opening to for any other reason, say the only one we will accept is something which deals with your ill health, because you don't have a control on that.
And then if that is the case, then let's narrow it so that we are able to debate a thing that is in front of us. But remember that the honorable member was raising another reason, which he believed that it may be of importance to actually influence decisions. Honorable Dambuza, you'll come back. Honorable Dambuza, has anything to raise?
I just wanted to check if the compelling reasons is not in the definition, is not defined. Because as I'm listening to the DG, he's saying it should be on health only, ill health. But I think even there are other circumstances. For instance, if you have got a bereavement and so on, sudden death in the family and so on. So I think, I'm not sure whether it should be appearing on the definitions. What do we mean when we talk about the compelling reasons? Safe to say, the chief director there has mentioned that it must not be beyond the international protection. So I think it must be clear on the definition, so that you, once you get to the act itself, you are able to understand what are they talking about. You don't take it for granted. Thank you.
Yeah, they must help us. Compelling to who?
Yeah.
Compelling to who? To the person that is adjudicating, or a SCRA or RAB, or compelling to the applicant. And then, so that then this thing is narrowed. Honorable Hussein? No, just hang on. Let the members speak, and they may give themselves an answer.
I get worried when the DG say it's now limited to health, because, you know, I asked for 5 rand and now he's coming to borrow money from me. It's made the situation worse. The point is simply this, Chair, is that I think that if we are going to limit it to that, it would be unfair. And that there must be an element of discretion that's applied in a reasonable and fair manner by the department, and we must include that in the law, so that we allow, give them the authority to make that call. I made the argument about why I think the similar nature should come out, but I think maybe the department must maybe spend some time on it and come back with a proposal. Can I speak on the other matter, or do you want to just deal with this now?
No,
all right.
So that they understand exactly what our troubles are. And then, like, as I've tried to put the spanners a little bit more, to say, you know, it's who this reason should be compelling to the applicant or to the person adjudicating the application or what. And then, because surely if we are clear on that one, then we'll be knowing the limitations and the expectations. But if the department is not ready, you really believe that there is still an exercise to be done. You are not forced to actually take decisions now. You must afford yourself an opportunity to actually apply your minds intelligently on this particular matter and advise us correctly. Honorable Rasmus.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just with regard to answering the question as to who this should be, it's clear. It's to the standing committee in this regard, Chairperson. So the standing, it's there in the second you said, to the satisfaction of the standing committee, reasons must be provided. And then on the issue of similar nature, we take that advice and we'll obviously go back as the department. We'll look into that and come back to Chair and the committee on that specific issue. Thanks, Chairperson.
Okay, yeah, go back then. If it is compelling to the standing committee, that means the standing committee is expected to apply its own judgment. Then the similar nature then must come off. Because the similar nature then will actually be frustrating them and limiting them to apply. Because once you say it's compelling, that means you expect them to think rationally on the things that are in front of them and make the judgment. Then you must think about that and be happy that that is what you are relying on them to make a call. Otherwise, if you also may expect them to make a call, but then you also try and limit them, and then you have to actually now make regulations now on the things that they must actually look at for them to actually make this judgment, and then you may be creating problems for yourself. Honorable Hussein, you wanted to continue. Welcome, Deputy Minister, in this troubled room. can you proceed?
Chair, I said earlier that my first preference would always be that we put in a prescribed time by which the decision is made, but this particular clause is not dealing with the application, it's dealing with the notice of intent. So I'm not sure you can include that in this clause. But the principle still remains the same, and I see no reason why it's not possible to inform an applicant within a prescribed time. I get the argument about PAJA and access to courts or whatever it is. The reality is simply this, Chair. You're dealing here with, you know, with people who ran away from their homes and left everything behind. These are the type of people that you're dealing with. And I think we must be sensitive to the fact they don't have easy access to courts and they're in a foreign country. And you need to take that into consideration. And for that reason, I think that if we act responsibly to show that we must try and make these decisions or communicate these decisions at least within a prescribed time, I mean, that will show good intent from our side, and that's my argument. This clause deals with informing them about the notice. So I'm now separating the two, and I'm still not convinced and like to hear what the department would say unless they can think about it. Why is it not possible for us to be able to say you must inform the applicant within 3 months? Or whatever the case might be, because there are people who are sitting, a decision is made that they don't know what that decision is. I get it that if they can't contact the person, then it's not their fault, but there must be at least a period in which that the department is held accountable for the work that they're supposed to do, and I think the best way to do that is to include it in the law itself, because then people will have a right to be able to hold you accountable for what you're supposed to do.
Honorable members, yes, on the issue of notification, prescribed time, I think there is no danger in putting it. And like as I've said before, that if it means from the time of submission of an application, and then that will be problematic, because the processing of the applications also include part of the work that the applicants must supply information, which is not in the powers of the department. then some of them, I'm sure, if they fill in the application forms, they may not provide adequate information. But the little information that they may be providing will point in a particular direction that, no, this particular person, we suspect that 1, 2, 3 is happening. But when you seek that information, then you don't get it. Then they may extend the time by not providing information or providing erroneous information that the department cannot be able to get to finality. So which means is that once an application has been submitted, it is not entirely in the hands of the department to determine the time of processing it. The applicant still plays a role in the manner, the quality of information submitted. But once the department has taken a decision, there is no reason why they should keep the decision away from the applicant for any particular long time. And then the issue of actually expecting the department within a particular time to actually communicate that decision, which I think even now, I think it should be the case that once there is a decision from RAB or SCRA that needs to go to these particular applicants, I think it goes in time. But prescribing time, I don't think it is a problem for communication of a decision or a notice that the department has already taken a decision on. It shouldn't be a problem. I'm not sure whether Erasmus and whether this particular matter makes sense, separating it from applications or whatever, to that of actually, after taking a decision, communicate the decision, then that should not be a problem if there is any prescribed time that is put in. Whether it is a week, a month, or it is 3 months, I don't think there is danger in that. But you can have time as well to talk to it. Yes, because it only means communicating decisions that have been taken. Yes.
Chair, thank you very much. If we look at, and maybe if we look at Section 24, Capital A, which deals with a review by the Standing Committee, in other words, the decisions that are being made, etc., we're saying that the Standing Committee must inform the Refugee Status Determination Officer at the Refugee Status...
Just slow down, because we are going to get confused here. Is this on the Refugees Amendment Bill itself?
Yes.
What you are saying?
It's closed.
Give us time to actually get to that particular page. Which page?
It's Clause 21.
Clause 21. Yes, review by
page 5. Yeah.
On page 12.
Yes. So if you look at subsection 3 of that section 21, it says that the Standing Committee must inform the Refugee Status Determination Officer at the refugee where the application for of its decision within 5 working days of such decision. So that's the decision making process.
Yes.
However, what we are currently busy with under clause 36 is withdrawal of refugee status. So what's going to happen once the Standing Committee wishes to withdraw that he or she, or the Standing Committee, needs to inform the specific person to whom this relates of its intention to withdraw. So we can't prescribe a specific period there. Once that becomes applicable, that we need to inform this person, and this is in line with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, you inform that person of his, and then that person can take the necessary steps to say, listen, we are going to withdraw your status, give us reasons, and then it's upon that applicant to provide reasons to the Standing Committee within a prescribed period, so that it's not delayed ad infinitum. So in other words, if we don't have a prescribed period for the specific individual to provide reasons as to why the Standing Committee should not proceed to withdraw the refugee status, it's going to hang, and you won't bring this to finality. So there is a prescribed, with the decision-making, there is a period that's already prescribed where the relevant applicants needs to be informed, and then this deals with the withdrawal, which is a separate issue, Chair.
Yeah, I think you have not sorted out our problems. Remember that if you take a decision to give the notice, it's a decision. You're finalizing the department that now you are going to send the notice. Then now what the Honorable Member is talking about is that when you have made that decision, then it should not hang with that decision with you for unreasonable time. And then this one now on clause 21 that you are saying, it's very clear this one is talking about 5 days. But what is the problem when you have taken a decision about to withdraw, and then to send that notice to that particular person within a particular period? The decision has been taken. That now we are sending this to withdraw the status. And then all that what the member is saying is that, why can't we have that decision communicated within a particular time so that you don't have undue delay, where you find that you take a decision this year in 2017, November, but then you don't communicate that. Somewhere in March 2018, then now somebody decides to communicate that to the person. And then it's problematic. I mean, just like other... like other IDs, certain persons, you know, ID documents that get blocked. You know, it's then they don't know. Some of them don't know that their ID is blocked. And when this person goes to the bank or he wants to go and buy a car, then he realizes that the ID has been blocked. He no longer have an ID. And it is six months or 12 months down the line. So, it's a similar thing. That I think that's what the member is actually trying to say. How can we get some efficiency in communicating the decision taken? Just like what we have provided here on the decision of the standing committee, you are talking about 5 days. But then it's on that one for the notice. And then if we could think about it, whether there is any danger in doing it. But one expects at the moment that you are actually communicating the decisions now. But you just wanted it to be in law. That's what you are saying, Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Honourable Member who raises the issue, because I do think that we need to think about the precise circumstances under which this applies. What has happened here is that the Standing Committee has decided to withdraw somebody's refugee status. That decision to withdraw has been communicated to the individual concerned within the prescribed period of 5 days. So that one is not the issue. The issue is when that notice is communicated to the person, that person is told you have X amount of time within which to make representations as to why we should not reconsider that decision, right? Or why we shouldn't finalize that decision. Now, that period of time surely has to be different for the different categories of people we are dealing with. If you look ahead in sub A, sub B, and sub C on in clause 36, you will see that the person whose refugee status is being withdrawn has either acquired refugee status fraudulently, dishonestly, etc., or there was an error in affording that person refugee status. And then the third category are people who legitimately acquired refugee status, but now things in their country has normalized, and everybody has ceased recognizing them as refugees, as we have done with the Angolans. Now, surely those categories should be treated differently. If somebody has acquired refugee status through fraudulent means, why should you give them 3 months within which to make representations to you? 30 days or 2 weeks might suffice. But if somebody has been a legitimate refugee, but now things have changed in the country, but they feel they still require refugee status, surely you should give them a longer period. And I think that perhaps we should be talking, therefore, Chairperson, rather than talking about the prescribed period, but prescribed periods. I think that would suffice. And also, remember, the part of our practical dilemma is always, how do we communicate with such people? So oftentimes we don't have addresses because they don't give us proper addresses. They don't want us to know where they are and so on. And very often what happens is that you have to give the person notice from the time they received So the 30 days will only run from the time they receive, and very often that takes time for us to be able to find people and so on. So there are those practical things that we hope to capture in regulations to say precisely from when does the time run. Is it from the time we give that five-day notice, when you receive the five-day notice, or is it from the time the decision has been made? Because if it is a general decision, such as the Angolans, you would remember that Cabinet communicated the decision to cease refugee status. We then published in the Government Gazette. So it's a more arduous process than just giving somebody a notice. So those different categories, I believe, should be treated differently under those circumstances, hence the issue of prescribed in regulations and not in the law, because then it becomes a bit too cumbersome, I think, to cater for all the different categories.
Yeah, Deputy Minister, I think what you have said, I think we agree. I think we are in line with it. But I think the argument that we're having, the argument that we are having is from the side of the department. From the side of the department. But from the side of this, and then that when you have given the notice within a particular period, they must respond and do that, it is fine. But then I think what the member was raising was from the side of the department, that when it has taken a decision to serve that notice, then that decision then must be done within a particular period of time. That so that we improve also efficiency of the department to actually communicate in time its own decisions. So that you don't have the department taking a decision to actually send the notice, but you find that they take 6 months to actually send that notice to the relevant applicant. I think that is what you are trying to say, is that as we want to get some sort of efficiency from the applicant, when we have given them the notice, then they must respond within a particular time. But the department as well, when it has taken a decision, then it must actually communicate that decision in time. They must not just have the whole time to communicate it. I think that's what he was proposing. But then now, I think it's, if we have to prescribe that particular time, then the time then has to talk to the processes that you need. From taking a decision at SCRA or RAB, whatever, and then how long does it take, what are the processes involved to actually get that becoming law and then now being translated to implementation to send to the relevant person. And then I think that's why I'm saying is if the department can just have a look at that so that it is known, at least it pushes the department as well to do its administrative part of the work of communicating decisions that have been taken in relation to that particular this notice or whatever. I think that is the call that was being made. And a little bit of thinking about it, and then if it improves the situation, then it is fine. If it doesn't, then it will be talked to. You want to clarify as much, Chief. Continue.
Chaverson, I think we hear the issue that is being submitted by honorable member. Our challenge in trying to respond to it is the realities of communicating back to the client, because in all material time we communicate to the file, because we do not have postal address of the clients. We do not have physical addresses of the clients. Now what we do is we communicate to the file, and we hope that on a particular day, whether the client wants to make amendments in his file or want to extend in his file, then we'll find the decision there. So that will mean then if we then want to address the issue of communicating in a prescribed period, we must go back and try to address the issue of the fact that refugees, by their very nature, most of them will not have these addresses in our system. So how do we deal with that, and how do we make sure that when they change addresses, when they change their residential addresses and so, and their contact details, how do we deal with that? Because then we might find ourselves, like as DM was indicating, when we tried to communicate to the Angolan refugees, we were sending to old addresses, and most of the letters came back, and it was just a waste of time and a waste of resources. So that's our real challenge, Chairperson and the women.
Okay. But at the end of the day, is that you are expected to communicate to the last address that you know. And then, of course, if you communicate to the file will actually say that you took a decision on the 15th of January, and then 2 weeks later, then you have communicated that decision to the person, a copy is in the file. Then it's fine. And because if the person comes to come and check, and then you'll find that that person will find that particular piece of paper. If the person doesn't come, and then, but the day that will come will find the communication in the file that says, this thing has been dealt, it has been communicated to you on this particular day, to the last known address or whatever. And then, if we are to take that particular decision to put a prescribed time, but like as I'm saying is that, I tend to believe that that is what we are doing now after decisions have been taken. And then, of course, the file gets updated on the status of the person. And if they come, then they find their answers of or whatever. Yeah, I think, Meraput.
I'm really listening very attentive on this issue, especially on the issue of communication, and also if the person wants to hide his own identity. Can't you give these people a unique number whereby even on the radios to say that number 576 what your refugee status is being adjudicated to, so it's possible for you to come to this office to come and get the feedback. Really, because you can see somehow there are people who don't want to be responsible. So as a responsive kind of government, can't we have a unique number that we are going to give these people so that you can be able to communicate in various kind of communication channels? That is my suggestion.
Yeah, well, I think honorable members, the intention here is to also assist the department to be clear from accusations from applicants and some of the people that are actually fighting for the possible applicants. That's why one will be saying that if there is a time limit of communicating, and then the department actually try and communicate to the last address, I think it will have stayed clear from any other accusation. Because, of course, we know that there are applicants who knows that they will never succeed in getting refugee status. But they go and apply for them to actually get that particular piece of paper that actually legalizes their presence in South Africa and then disappear into our communities. And they will never go back to go and check because they definitely know that the country where they come from, there is no problem. There is no reason to actually give them that the refugee status. But all what they are doing, using that system only to get inside the country and have a piece of paper that actually protects them and then disappear into the communities, then they'll never go back and check. That's why one is saying is that if the decision has been communicated in the file, whether it's a rejection or whatever, and then it should be able to serve the purpose in a particular time, of course. I think it is a point, of course, that once a decision has been taken or a decision is communicated, and then it should be communicated in time. Everything should be done efficiently. You see, but if this thing adds some efficiency, then it should be supported. But if it is actually not enhancing efficiency, of course, then we must talk to it a little bit much more. McKay, you wanted to put the spanners?
No, Chairperson. Chairperson, yeah. I just wanted to talk to a reality, and I think Manda tried to do that. The fact that most of them do not have addresses. They come to South Africa having no address at all, the majority, and it makes communication extremely difficult, or in fact not only difficult, impossible, because you only communicate when you see them. When someone comes to the office and comes and collects or does this, then you can communicate. So it does make it difficult. The majority of them, we had plastic land that just burnt out a couple of months ago in Pretoria, a new informal settlement, no addresses there, mostly foreigners living there, our clients living there. There are no addresses for them. So if you have to communicate, it is only you communicate when such a person comes in for service into that particular office. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Hussein.
Chair, I completely understand the difficulties under which the department has to operate to try and communicate with people. But the point for me is simply this, is that not only is it the issue about communication, I get it. If you can't get hold of somebody, you can't get hold of that person. And if you're communicating to the file, then why can't you communicate to the file within that prescribed period of time? How difficult is that? Because the principle is that the department must deal with this thing, finish and clear within that period of time. Then you held, you know, there's a sense of accountability in which decisions are made and communicated. Because that is currently a part of the problem with it. That we have with the whole system. And I'm not sure that it's going to cause a massive problem if you have to communicate to the file as you do. You want to withdraw the thing, you want to give notice, then give notice within a prescribed period of time.
Okay. It looks like we may not finish this discussion.
No, Chair, maybe say English. Chair, I don't understand. Seemingly to me, it's not the department which must communicate with them, it's the person who must come back. Let's read this sentence again, Chair. It says the standing committee must inform each affected person contemplated in subsection of each withdrawal his or her status as a refugee, as well as the reason for the withdrawal. And such person may, which is the refugee.
We do understand that
may within prescribed period make a written submission with regard to that. My understanding as well, Chair, is that if this thing is in the regulations, we can change without coming back to Parliament.
Yeah.
But if now we put a date here and then we improve things as we're improving now with the systems, and then, well, if now you say within prescribed, it means that in the regulations, those dates are going to be there. Because you look at them and say, now we must start with 3 months, we must start with 2 months. As we improve your systems, then you change it. Because to me, this is giving the person to come back.
We do understand that one, DG. That part we understand. That's why even the deputy minister was explaining that one. That one, we are all comfortable. We don't have a problem on the side of the applicant. What the honorable member was proposing was saying, because you are putting a time limit for the applicant to respond in a particular time when you have issued the notice.
Yeah.
Then he was proposing a new provision that also the department must operate within a particular period when it is actually have taken the decision and communicated to the person. That's what it is. It's actually a new proposal from him.
Okay, I think that's
on the other side now of the department, the originating body, to say, when you have taken a decision to issue that notice of withdrawal, then you should do it within a particular period.
To communicate.
To communicate, to make sure that that person get that particular notice. Now you are saying, It is difficult because we don't have addresses to these people. And then we understand now the argument that says you communicate to the file. And then now he's saying, yes, if you've got that particular notice to say now we intend to withdraw your status, and then we want you to respond within 30 days or within 60 days or whatever, then that notice then must go to that particular file within a particular period of time. That the day that person pitches up, then we'll find that notice, and then in that particular file. Because what Mr. McKay is saying is that only the day that this particular person pitches up at the office to check, that is the time that they will know. And then that means if that particular intention is sitting in the file because you don't know where the person is, the day he pitches up, then he will find that particular notice. His date of issue then will be within those particular limits that you have actually provided for yourself. Rather than to have a situation where when the person arrives, and then you find that officers now are phoning relevant persons, is how far are you with this particular matter of Mr. so-and-so. So if it is not in a file within the particular period, that means that that decision, there is no decision. I think that is what we are understanding. That's what I was trying to explain to what the Deputy Minister was saying, that on the other part of the applicant to respond within certain particular period, it is fine. And then, of course, it's after the date that that person has received the notice. What Honorable Hussein was talking about was saying that the department then must not have all the time of communicating this decision or this notice, so that when that decision has been taken to issue the notice, it must be done all within a particular period of time as well, to ensure that there is efficiency on the other side as well. That's what you are actually raising. That's why I'm saying it's then for you to actually talk to that, like what the Deputy Minister was saying, was there had to be consideration of the process.
Yes.
The process that takes place when you have taken that decision of the notice, what steps do you need to take, what time is needed to be... If it needs to take about 3 months of gazetting or whatever, then you must you must allow that particular time.
Sir, yes. To say we'll come back on.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Mekenye? You withdrew. And then any other one who wants to speak? Remember, we've got a big document in front of us. Are you all in agreement with the bill? All the changes that we are having in here, after the discussions of the presentations that we had and the responses of the department, and then let's hear from the state law advisors. I think you are being ready now. You are being ready to speak. But I'm starting there at the corner first. Do you have any other thing to help us out?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair, I was actually going to speak after the department. It's just something that I picked up when I went through the bill again. I have discussed it shortly with the department this morning. Just looking at clause 14 of the bill, it's on page 8 of the bill, not the amendments made by the department, but of the original bill. Chair, I just wanted perhaps us to consider the wording of subsection 1 of that specific section 20A that we are inserting here, read with subsection 4. And it's basically just a bit of a drafting issue at the moment. It doesn't read well if you read it as it is. So I just wanted perhaps to ask the Chair if we could also just consider, when we consider changing or amending some of the other issues that were raised today, that we could perhaps just be granted an opportunity to look at Section 20A again. Because if we read subsection 4, it says any information gathered in terms of subsection 2 may be used for purposes of, and then paragraph A says instituting criminal, civil, or disciplinary proceedings against a person referred to in subsection 1. But it's now very technical, and if you go to subsection 1, there is not really a person that's being referred to, except right at the end, there where we refer to the person in Roman numeral 2. So it's just a bit of a drafting issue that if I may request, that we could perhaps have a look at before finalizing the A-list for the committee. It doesn't read very well at this stage because it says, subsection 1 says the Director General must, as soon as possible after the commencement of this Act and from time to time thereafter, for the purposes of, and then it first lists the purposes, And then if you look at Roman numerals 1 and 2, it seems to be addressing paragraph B when it refers to the members that can be, that must be directed by the Director General. So instead, it must actually speak to the whole of subsection 1. But that's very technical, Jay.
It looks like, of course, that we are not, I'm not following you, but I can pick up that you have got challenges on this particular area. I'm sure is that the department should be able, I think they are following what you are saying. And then, sorry, and then I think they would, they should be able to help us. But also I think on 26, just before is the department actually helps us as well. Is it clause 26 or you see where the deputy minister was talking about the periods instead of period and then periods, and what is the view of Erasmus and the other members on it? Now I'm just lost where that particular clause is. There?
Chair, clause 27 on page 13 of the bill.
Yeah.
Which amends section 36 of the Act that deals with withdrawal of refugee status.
Yeah.
Chair, obviously what we'll do is we'll also go back and look at that, because as I understood the Deputy Minister, we're indicating within the prescribed period. It's maybe just to add an S there.
Yes.
To make it. So we'll look at the drafting style and format in that regard as well, and just align it with the discussions that we had taken into consideration, Chair.
Okay. And then the ones that is from the state law advisors, I think talking to 20A. Did you follow what she was saying?
We follow, Chair, and we'll have a discussion on that specific.
You'll have a discussion on it. Okay. Honourable members, is there any other thing on the bill that we need to talk to?
Chair, I just want to raise just one issue for now, if you don't mind, and it relates to clause 2B. It talks about exclusion from refugee status. If we just go there, please, for a moment. I'm now referring to the actual bill itself, sorry. Not this document any longer. It's on page 3. Of the actual bill. And the question, I tried to see if there was a response from in the public hearing, so I don't waste your time, but I'm not picking it up, and if you've covered it, I apologize. But the question I just want to ask is this. And that clause reads, has committed a crime, so a person is excluded from refugee status if he has committed a crime outside of the Republic which is not of a political nature, and which, if committed in the Republic, would be punishable. Get that part. Is there any circumstances that, given the experience that you've got, that asylum seekers commit a crime outside of the country which is not political, but in line with the convention?
Are you done? You remember the creatures? Can you proceed, Erasmus?
Just a very short answer to this is, you get instances of rape, for instance. It's a Schedule 1 offense. So obviously if that happens in the country, we need to be able to, that would be a Schedule 1 offense, and there will be imprisonment if it was committed within South Africa. So those are the areas that we're covering in this regard, just to mention one. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, if you don't mind, some
have committed some serious robberies and run into South Africa and apply as for asylum seeker. and whereas the other side, they are looking for them for robbery and all that, bank robberies. And I think that there were a couple of individuals who were being pursued from their countries, having engaged in serious robberies, but being in South Africa, and the rest. And yeah, you can make a photo up. I'm sure you heard the explanation. I was just simply giving what I thought I know as well, somewhere around. But the intention is also to keep South Africa a little bit clean and make it sure that it is not a safe haven for criminals. And only genuine people that are running away from persecution and death, that they must be assisted in terms of the conventions, but not those that are running from being locked up because they are criminals in their own countries, and to be treated with kids' love in our country. Then otherwise, other countries would regard South Africa as a safe haven. Like, of course, as we are being, it's accused now on certain individuals that are within the country. You remember the one that was purported to be involved in the Kenyan whatever, that she has gone through South Africa here and used even South African documentation, to run around and create problems of terrorism act in other countries. We need to move away and try and safeguard ourselves that we are not abused. And then in the name of our refugee system. You may proceed, Honorable Hussein.
Yeah, can I just say that I think often the mistake that we make when we write laws is that we write it to prevent the terrorists from coming. I get that part. But not everybody is a terrorist. So you want to make sure that you write up the laws in such a way that it protects those people who genuinely need the protection. In the previous argument that I made, there was the generalization about you don't have addresses. But there will be circumstances where individual circumstances justify it. So I want to give you this example. And you use the example of rape, for example. And so all it takes, actually, for a government or for anyone to prevent that person from becoming a refugee in South Africa, a genuine asylum seeker, is to charge that person for rape in the other country. It would be different if he's been committed for a crime, because it says has committed a crime outside of the Republic. So if you charge the person there, and, I can be charged for a crime quite easily. So convicted for me is the important word, and I wonder whether that should not be changed as such. Instead of saying committed a crime, because I can make an allegation, and in someone's running away from another country because of political persecution, all that needs to happen then is some politician needs to go and charge that person, and then there's the allegation he's committed a crime. But if he's convicted, it's a different story. Because if you go further in that same clause, you've got there under G, which I think is sufficient to cover the argument that the department is making, which is I accept. We don't want South Africa to become a haven for criminals. Nobody, no other country in the world would want that. And that's not my intention. But I think clause G covers that. 4G covers it quite clearly. Is a fugitive from justice in another country where the rule of law is upheld by a recognized judiciary. So that, I think, that clause on its own satisfies the department. But that 4B, for me, I think is problematic because many asylum seekers will run away from their country for political reasons. We know that in many African countries as well, in the politics that politicians play, they would find all sorts of ways to try and prevent people from running away because they want to get hold of them. And merely just charging the person for a crime in terms of this then prevents that person from getting a refugee status. That's how I'm understanding it, unless I'm incorrect.
Okay, Honorable Kenya. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know maybe whether I'm out of order, but I think on the same vein that you are talking about these criminal activities, also I'm concerned about those crimes which they commit here in South Africa. And then the refugee now
has been given a bail according to the Criminal Act, and now they go back home without being... I just want to check, what is your taking in this? Because people are complaining because when they commit these crimes, maybe they stole something, they had a theft, and then they are given the bail, granted the bail, and then go back to their countries. Now, what I just want to check, what is your taking as in case of those in those cases in the border, when they are in the borders, back home, the refugee status now, not the asylum seekers. Thank you.
Okay, any other one that wants to have a take on this issue? I mean, honorable members, you can also either confirm the other members' view or contrast the other members' views. We are almost talking to ourselves, and the department could be called upon to assist us where we need some more clarity on the issues that we are discussing. Is there no any other... Okay, and then the department was Erasmus, clause 4. That is 4B, and then read in conjunction with 4G. I think that is what Honorable Hussein was indicating. Although that under 4B, 41B, crime of political nature, I think, is excluded, if I'm reading it correctly. Yes. Can Erasmus speak to it and also read with G and make us clear?
Thanks, Chairperson. With regard to 41B, has committed crime outside the Republic, we're using the words in terms of the con. Here we're sitting with the international handbook, etc. We're using the precise wording as utilized in, so that we aligned with the conventions as well. So that is why we're using has committed a crime outside the Republic, because it's gone. So we're just aligning with the conventions. We have to do that in terms of our law. Then the next issue, Chair, is that which is not of a political nature. So when an Honourable Hussein mentions the issue about political nature, if it's not of a political nature, if it is of a political nature, then obviously this specific paragraph is not applicable. Okay, but if it is of a political nature, it would be applicable. Chair, with regard to G, that's also just alignment with our international instruments. If I can jump to Honourable Kenya's request or inputs that she made as well, we've covered under paragraph E in clause 41E. You can see there has committed a crime in the Republic. There we deal with where crime is committed in the Republic and it falls within the schedule of offences. That person is then excluded from refugee status as well. So it's an exclusionary clause that we deal with there in that specific instance as well. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, you're almost talking about criminals. We are excluding criminals. But the other one, under B, is the person that has committed a crime in another country, but that kind of crime is a crime that is actually, if it was committed inside here, it is punishable. Then that person then is excluded. Then the next one that I think E that is made reference to is those that are actually within the country that commit those crimes. And then G, of course, is these are the ones that already there are decisions in their home countries, then they are there. Instead of going to jail, then they run away and then find their way to South Africa. They are fugitives running away. And then the kind of people that we are speaking to. And then do they make good asylum seekers? Do they make good refugees? These kind of people, that's the question we must ask ourselves. And then, Honorable Sobem Kalipi, whichever is applicable.
Chair,
yes.
Just a clarity, which crime is of political nature? Crime. Not punishment, crime.
Come on, lawyers. And then state law advisor, where is she? Which crime is called a crime of political nature? then just be ready to also assist the department. I'm sure is that we know the struggles of South Africa, and then the crimes that they were taken to be, and then the amnesties that we have gone through, and then those ones have been actually taken out and say, no. Yeah, you want to take it on before Erasmus? Yes. No, if you can take us on.
I want to make an example in South Africa to say, you remember, you go and be involved in a march, and then there's a law, then it says now you get arrested. That march, I was involved in it because of a political reason, but now you are charging me because of a particular act which you have. And then you said, I've committed a crime. I says, no, what is it? So I mean, that those are what things which were happening here as an example.
Yeah, just hold on a little bit. We have also a state law advice right at the end. Is there any input you can make to explain that? Remember that South Africa, we've traversed through this. And then the process that Desmond Tutu has engaged as a chairperson looked at all these things. And then we should be a lot more clearer ourselves, unlike other countries. We've gone through this, where people we know were categorized as criminals locked up, but as terrorists and all that because of political activities. And then when that reconciliation process then happened, and then through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, some of all those criminal activities that were purported under the apartheid period, and then were actually waived off. And then that's why even in candidature to stand as a member of parliament, and then all those particular political crimes that you were in before the unbanning of political parties and the rest, then are not considered to be criminal activities that can prohibit you to be a member of parliament. State law advisor, yeah?
Chair, because she's a state law advisor,
yes.
She must come with that law's perspective.
Yeah.
Just allow us, bush lawyers here, just to vent out in order to have clarification and then give it.
Okay.
Yes, I just want to check one thing, because we need to be clear here, because we are documenting this bill, and soon will be an act.
Yeah.
For instance, here, DG, in a march, you can be arrested to be in a march, but as far as I remember, in a march you must commit a crime. Maybe you must shoot or you must burn an office. That you commit a crime. It's a different story. I don't think it's treated as a political involvement when you have banned schools there in your area, AD.
No, it's here, a crime.
Let me just make another example. The CIC, Commander-in-Chief of EFF, is attending court cases under 1956 Righteous Act about the land. That is a political arrest that he may face, because there is a law that is against talking of land and so on and so on. Recently, the president of the ANC Youth League, when he was addressing in Estenga, said the minister of Ugoldan is in Mbimbi. What does that mean? During the apartheid years, during the apartheid struggle, do you remember, Mbimbi was neglected, put a tie on Mbimbi. And then, for instance, if that statement means that we must ban the Minister of Finance because he's Mbimbi, that is not a political crime. This is a crime on its own. So we must be clarified if the department is telling us about political crime here, because we must know, Guti, what is it? DG, I think I have made myself clear.
Well, is there any other member that wants to either assist the Honorable Mkhalipi or support what she's saying, or put any other version to what she's saying before we allow the department to respond. But I still want to welcome Honorable Melder. I've been seeing a person right at the end, but I was not really aware that it's you. But welcome, and then I think you have seen all. You should be able to assist assist us. Yes. And then is there any contribution you want to make right at the end there on this particular matter that Honorable Mukalip is raising, with what are political crimes? And then I think we should be knowing better ourselves as South Africans. I'm still adamant that we should be knowing better. And then also I'm sure if you can get to Lesotho, they will be knowing best now, just after what has happened in the past couple of months, of course, leading to the intervention of the Deputy President. And then if you go to Somalia, you go to quite a good number of countries, and then you'll actually understand that where you've got political uncertainty and clashes, and then other people then are pursued for taking particular positions, political positions, not necessarily committing a crime, but because they are viewed in a particular light, and then whatever the ruling party or faction or grouping, then may pursue others in a manner that they seek to embolden themselves in power by dealing with those that are oppositions or those that are not in agreement. There are quite a lot of things. Of course, it's that others, of course, they would be breaking the law of the country, which brings another element. I mean, it's, if Honorable Mukalip is saying that there is a righteous act, and then the question is it repealed? If it's not repealed, then that means it's still in force. And then if you break it, then you'll be charged according to it until any amendment or repeal it is effected. Deputy Minister, assist us. You have seen some of them. You have seen part of this history.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we all generally know the kinds of political crimes that pertain under specific circumstances in particular countries. I think what we're dealing with here is a clause that speaks to people committing crimes outside of the Republic. So I think that's very important that we understand that. So you may have political situations in certain countries that are different from ours, right? So we have to think about what is the category of person that we're dealing with here. The issue is a very important clause in the sentence is somebody has committed a crime which, if committed in the Republic, would be punishable by imprisonment without the option of a fine. So we're talking about fairly serious crimes. Because obviously if it's somebody participating in a march in another country, and that march is illegal, unless that country has laws that say if you participate in an illegal march, you will go to jail, chances are you're not going to be able to come to South Africa anyway because you're in jail. So we're talking about a very small set of circumstances here. Somebody who, for instance, committed, we'll use Advocate Erasmus's explanation of rape, and he manages to escape the authorities and flee to South Africa. When in South Africa, he says, I am seeking asylum because I'm being falsely accused in my country, or whatever the issue is. I'm being persecuted for my political beliefs. What we have here is an assessment that has to be done by the RSDO, because the clause says an asylum seeker does not qualify for refugee status for the purposes of the Act if the refugee status determination officer has reason to believe that he or she has committed a non-political act in that country, which if committed here would have resulted in that person going to jail. And that's the category that we're dealing with. People who are committing crimes in other countries which we regard as serious in this country. So if it is something like a march, obviously in our country we don't regard that necessarily as a serious offense. So that would not exclude somebody from seeking asylum in our country. But if it is something like murder or rape or even robbery, those are Schedule 2 type of offenses, which if committed in the Republic, we would jail people for it. Our own citizens would go to jail for it. There's no reason why we would treat other people differently coming into our country because they say they are asylum seekers. So that's really what we're dealing with here. And just to add to Honorable Hussein's question, you know, we have had very, very pertinent examples of this coming into our asylum system. The chair mentioned a name that you would know. But there have been several instances where people are really fugitives of justice in their country. And they come and they, it's very easy to say it's because I'm supporting the opposition party in that country that I'm being persecuted for my political beliefs. And each case has to be assessed on its merits. Clearly, there may be instances such as, for example, a very difficult one. I don't know how I would decide this matter. Andries Breivik, you recall he is the ultra-right nationalist in was it Sweden, who shot 65 children because of his political beliefs. And they were all from a liberal political camp or something of that sort. Now, somebody like that comes into our country, somehow manages to evade the authorities there, finds his way into our country. We'll have to assess, based on this clause, whether we would allow such a person to access our asylum regime. It's a very, very serious crime to kill 65 children at point-blank range. Now, you'll have to assess the degree to which he was motivated by his political beliefs or whether this man is just a serial killer. And that becomes a very, very difficult decision to make. But if you don't have a clause like this, then unfortunately the person is entitled to apply for refugee status and may very well get it in our country and walk around free, and our children are at risk. And I think that's the consequence of not having a clause like this.
Yeah, I think what then we should be reading in here is that this is just an enabling provision to be able to ensure that we don't let in hard criminals. Hussein, you wanted to make a follow-up?
Perhaps I should capture it like this, and I don't in the least disagree with the Deputy Minister. I think we're on the same page in that. I don't think any country will want a person like that to come and through their borders. But I'm looking at it from through the perspective of somebody who is not a Andesh, who is innocent, who is a genuine asylum seeker, but because the political party that he comes from or the political party he's fighting against wants to kill him in the home country and they don't want him to disappear, I mean to run away, that all it takes is for him to charge him. And then he comes through the port of entry in South Africa and we say, sorry, you actually are charged for a crime, you must go back to where you came from. So I'm looking at it through that perspective. And maybe I don't have the answer to it. And the question that I put to the minister, Deputy Minister, is this, is how do we write the law in a manner that protects the citizens of South Africa from the Andeshes of the world, but at the same time protect the genuine asylum seekers in the spirit of the Geneva Convention? I think that's the balance I'm asking that we try to find. And I don't have the answer to that, and I think if we can find the solution to that, I would have a little bit comfort.
Yeah, I think maybe the process should be explained, because surely anyone that presents himself at the border and then is not sent home, I think is given a particular document which actually that person currently then must take about 5 to 10 days then to an office, and then there will be the application be looked at. During that, that is when certain things get unraveled, and that person would be inside the country if he actually runs away from where he comes from. So it's I don't think there is a system that says right at the port of entry, anyone that presents as an asylum seeker, a decision will be taken there and say go back, make a U-turn. No, I don't think our systems say so. Deputy Minister.
In fact, the clause is, you're quite right, Chair, the clause specifically speaks to the RSDO. So you have to be able to put your case. So in the instance where you say that there are trumped up charges, in your example, against the individual, the onus is on that individual to show the RSDO, because this is the opportunity that you have to make out your case in an application. That in fact, these are the circumstances and not the ones that the government have now put forward in the media or wherever. And the RSDO, being a consummate professional, will assess the evidence before him or her and decide on the merits of each case. And that's why I underlined that issue, because each case presents itself with unique sets of circumstances. And based on what is presented before the RSDO, a decision is made. And of course, this clause does not prevent the RSDO from saying, actually, these are very likely trumped up charges against you, and therefore you are entitled to refugee status because you have made your case. So this will never happen at the border. It will never happen to stop a person applying. This is only in assessing whether you move from an asylum seeker into refugee status or not.
Chairperson.
On the side. Yeah, Honorable Melder, and then Honorable Mnisi then will follow.
Thank you, Chairperson. Now, on the same issue, if you look at the wording of Clause 4B, it clearly says has committed an offense. There's a huge difference between being accused of committing an offense and has committed the offense.
Okay. Honorable Nisi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think we can summarize the whole thing by saying that we can't have a wholesale approach on this case. Each and every case should be treated on its merit. I think that will pave the way forward for us.
Okay. In principle is that we are having an enabling provision for us to be able to administer and be able to keep others outside that are not welcome. Under certain circumstances, and those that are genuine, then there is a process to follow them to ensure that they enjoy the protection necessary. Roland?
Thanks, Chairperson. Yes, sorry, I didn't research before I came what is regarded as a political crime, because I think the wording is taken as it is from the United Nations Convention. And I just quickly looked at it, and there doesn't seem to be a fixed definition, which makes me to think that what the DM said is the approach that we must take, because courts have given definitions to it, but it only happens in courts, in case law. So each situation must be regarded on its own merits, and in that way we can determine what a political crime is, or when it is, or when it is not one. That is why there isn't a definition, a fixed definition, even in the conventions, in the international conventions, as to what may be regarded as a political crime.
Okay. it looks like even ourselves, I think we'll go and inform ourselves what that means. But like as I'm saying, is that we are better positioned than South Africans. We have got history on this, and then we should be understanding it a lot more faster than others. Honourable members, it looks like you no longer have appetite on this particular bill. It looks like you no longer have appetite to speak to. Remember that we have got provisions here, ending up to page 14. 14 pages of this particular act, and then we have discussed certain amendments that have been brought today, and then we have talked now to certain clauses that they are in the main bill. Then they make me to understand that now you are happy about this particular bill in front of you, these amendments. But then we have to allow the department then to bring in a cleaner document, and together with a set of whatever amendments in the form of the ADs. Yes, so that then we come and have a look at that. But then the only challenge that we are having is that the input that Honorable Hussein wanted to make has now the capacity to stop us from rolling. Come again? Well, he indicated that he's still going to strive to actually get them finished, but I thought that it looks like there is some sort of happiness now here for the bill, and then we should be able to agree that the department go and make a cleaner document, and then when we come back, then we come and have a look at that. Is that the view that we should do, honourable members? Honourable Hussein?
Chair, can I maybe just assist you so that we don't delay the process? Perhaps maybe what we could do is, I'm sure we're going to deal with the line-by-line deliberations at some point. And
yes.
And instead of adding one additional step to the process, what I can possibly do is to propose amendments at that stage. And then we just deal with it. If we don't agree, we don't agree, and then we just move on. If you're happy to deal with it like that, I think it might solve the problem. Or alternatively, if you want to allow yet another step, I'm quite happy, but I'm just proposing that as a means to assist.
Well, the steps that are left, I think, is to agree on the A-list. The amendment that we have seen here, they're going to be put clean, then we agree on them, then the next step, and then we go on a clause by clause on the B-list. So I think is that, but I'm sure is that your satisfaction now, together with all other members, should be indicating to me that all of you are happy about the amendment bill. You know, of course, is that if we go home today, you may have a different idea, but the collective at the moment, I think, here is that we have been clarified on some of the things that we wanted to clarify. Then where we are agreeing with the department on our views, the department then has actually accepted, and then some, of course, I'm sure there is one or two where you're just going to apply your mind and see whether you agree with us or not, and then we will welcome that, and then if it comes in those cleaner documents, then we should be able to do so. Are we done? Yes, thank you very much, and then department then will await you and then and the drafters and the state law and our legal team here to produce the document that can help us to move forward, agree on the amendments to put them as it is, and then we go to a clause by clause and then finalize this particular matter. Thank you very much. And then can we then now speak to the Border Management Authority. Controversial. Come again? You want a break? How many minutes? We can just restart. We can just restart at 5:02. No, it's 5 minutes. Thank you very much. And then, if then we can get those that are responsible for the BMA to get ready to take us through.